We're in lesson number 53, the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 26, verse 21 is where we'll start. David has just pleaded with Saul not to kill him with his 3,000 men. If the Lord had arranged this, let the Lord kill him. Let the Lord kill him. And that caused Saul, in the kindness of David, to say to Saul, your men have not protected you. Look, here's your spear. Here's your jug of wine. It caused Saul, it brought attention to Saul's conscience. Verse 21 says this, then Saul said, I have sinned. Return my son David, for I will not harm you again because my life was precious in your sight this day. Behold, I have played the fool and have committed a serious error. And David replied, behold the spear of the king. Now let one of your young men come over and take it. The Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Lord delivered you into my hand today. But I refuse to stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. Now behold, as your life was highly valued in my sight this day, so may my life be highly valued in the sight of the Lord, and may he deliver me from all distress. Then Saul said to David, blessed are you, my son David. You will both accomplish much and surely prevail. So David went his way, and Saul returned to his place. Saul repented. Saul was given his sword back and most likely his bottle of water too. For David would not have wanted to keep anything that belonged to the Lord's anointed. And Saul went home and David went back to the camp. It is at this point of the story where I am taken to grief in my heart because I know of a pastor, an anointed pastor who began a church and led it to be one of the greatest congregations as part of the Lord's bride over more than 5 decades. And when some of the men who were under him on his staff decided that it was time for him to leave the church as its head minister, they planned a long and calculated mutiny. The pastor was tricked to participate in meetings that were meant to provide a way for the church to seek a new pastor if he ever retired or if he died in office. And near the end of this 2-year charade, all the staff was finally made aware of the work that the committee had done. And they were told that once the plan was finalized, which it was, this finalized plan would simply go into a drawer for when the time was needed, when the pastor retired or if he happened to die. The pastor participated all the months, 24 months, thinking this is what was going to happen. It was going to go into a drawer. But with evil men, the reason is never the reason. The lie was that the plan would be put in the drawer. That's the lie. That was never to be the case. Within 7 days after the plan was completed, men went to the pastor's office and told him the day of his retirement. Now, these were laymen, sheep of the church, who had been led astray by these specific staff members under the pastor. These laymen had been manipulated to believe that it was the Lord's will that they act on behalf of the Lord and the church to end the anointed pastor's term. They did not give him a chance. Oh, he had a chance. He could have said, let's put it in the drawer and I will entreat the Lord concerning my retirement. Had they been honest with him all the way along for 2 years, he could have been entreating the Lord for 2 years. But they were not honest with him and their intentions were not honest. It was a surprise to him when they said it to him. Had he said, let's put it in the drawer, the men would have been faced with the decision, well, do we take it to the church floor or do we not? The pastor knew that and he could not bear that because you see that church had never had a foul word spoken or a word of dissension on the floor of the church in his entire time from founding the church until that day. He could not bear to have something like this come to the floor of the church because there were those who were going to go along with terminating him, a few people, no more than 45, by the way, and there was the whole crowd who was going to be against it, and surely some foul words would be said. And in addition, I'll tell you this, it was interesting. The pastor thought that the whole staff was involved and knew the intentions from the very beginning, and they were all in unison, but they weren't. In reality, only 2 truly knew what was involved. The rest of the staff knew what the pastor knew. It was going to be stuck in a drawer. That's the lie that had been told. The pastor was terminated. When you are told your retirement date, you are not retiring. You are being terminated. The mutiny, instigated by specifically two of the pastor's top men, touched the Lord's anointed. David, Saul's top man, would not touch the Lord's anointed. We can only wait to see what the Lord and how the Lord will handle these men in eternity. And do not be ignorant in this point. The Lord will handle them for touching the Lord's anointed. The Lord would have handled David had he touched the Lord's anointed. Know that for sure. We come now to the most unfortunate chapter break in our scripture. We must look on into chapter 27 and verse 1 at least for where this story should go. This chapter break should not be here. With this unfortunate chapter break, we must continue to see the conclusion, David's conclusion to his meeting with Saul in the dark of the morning. Chapter 27, verse 1. Then David said to himself, "Now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Saul then will despair from searching for me anymore in all the territory of Israel, and I will escape from his hand." When conflicts occur repeatedly in a person's life, sometimes it is just best to move on. Literally, move to a new location, to start fresh, to get away from evil. I have always known that there are places in this world where evil is personified every day against good people. There is hardly a day that we do not hear on our national news programs of some evil tyrant persecuting his own people, striking fear in them for them to obey his every command. Our history books are filled with such atrocities. But it's always been amazed to me that such places exist in our own neighborhoods in the United States. At my last church, I sat safe in a neighborhood. Even the homeless folks who lived under the bridge were kind and fit right into the neighborhood surroundings. We fed them when they ran out of money, out of their monthly allotment that they got on their government little card every month when it's been spent, and mostly of it was always spent on wine and strong drink. And in gratitude, they would come help support us in the disasters of the hurricanes and stuff. They would come and work along with us. And when we sorted food, they would come and help with the food drive. They would help with disaster relief, and they would help with work projects, going here and there, hauling sheetrock and plywood and nailing nails. And in gratitude, we would help them. And we always tried to influence them to get out of the totally enclosed and floored tents to keep them away from the insects at night. In fact, I would buy them these tents. I cannot tell you how many totally floored and net protected tents that whether it's rain, sleet, snow, insects or what, they would be safe in the night. They were grateful. However, just a few streets over and south was an apartment complex that was so filled with evil. Most of the people living in those apartment complex have large government checks, not small ones like the homeless. They did not spend their money so much on wine, but rather on drugs. They were always short each month for rent. And as you might not know, drugs tend to always be associated with guns. Now, I'm not against guns. I have my share. But I am horrified by what evil people on drugs and alcohol do with guns. Daily, anger fits flared in that complex and guns were fired. Daily reports came of robberies and beatings among the peoples in that complex. One day my wife called me and told me that she had gotten lost in the area behind the Dairy Queen. And I asked her to tell me the cross street that she was at, and I quickly told her how to turn around and get out of there. I asked her to tell me that, and she could tell that fear was in my voice. And once she was out and safe, she asked me, "Why were you so fearful?" And I told her that people in that area were weakly hit by stray bullets. It was, and is still, not a safe place for anyone, in my opinion. It is filled with every vice known to man, prostitution, drug running, you name it. In Clear Lake, where I live, in the Houston area, the same became true. For 30 years, no crime, no evil. But in the last decade, pockets of evil have developed. People who lived there for 50 years did what David is about to do in our story. They found it best to just move, and they did. In my 48 years of ministry, many times I've ministered to people in evil situations. One that became a glory to God in the highest moment was when a person who had fallen in with some worthless fellows, godless in every way, dragged the person under threat to another state. We could do nothing to stop it because that person was over 18 years of age. All we could do was pray. Regularly, reports came from the ungodly life that was going on in the house. Finally, the person was convicted, got in a car, and drove back to Texas. The person testified that health was declining with diseases, and medical help was needed. The only way to continue living was to get away from the evil and get help. He made the right choice. We speak about the importance of families often, and they are important, but in some cases, families are toxic. Some families have generations of toxic behaviors. Crime families are called crime families because if you're in the family, your business is going to be the business of crime. Drug families are the same. Drunk families are the same. When you are around it, it is normal life to you. In such cases, sometimes a person who wants out of the evil must make the hard decision to abandon the family and take the chance on a new life away from the expected and taught life in that biological family. I have had the opportunity to help a few in this case, but not many. Those who I have tried to help have had the privilege and been privileged to help. They have flourished, by the way. However, from time to time, because of their good choices and their new property, family members have arrived on their doorsteps expecting help. Help to continue in their own ways, their own evil ways. Even in David's day, he must have seen all that I have seen, and he knew that the only salvation for his life was to leave the promised land and go where the king of Israel had no jurisdiction. Where would he go? It is interesting that he chose the Philistines. The constant enemy of Israel, the constant thorn in the side of Israel. Saul would probably think that David was hiding himself and his men somewhere in the promised land, but David would be among his enemies. However, after searching the land in vain, Saul would give up, David suspects. It was David's plan. David moved on to the land of the Philistines, but David's plan did not lay out as planned. Someone knew where David went and told Saul. And so we come to the story of the movement of David and David's time with the Philistines. It is interesting because David lived with the king of Gath, the very king who he had previously acted like a madman in order to escape his grips. Chapter 27, verse number 2. So David arose and crossed over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish the son of Maok, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each with his household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam, the Jezreelite, and Abigail, the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. Now it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he no longer searched for him. The first time David stood before Achish, he was alone. This time, when David stood before Achish, quite a mass of humanity stood with him. Almost every time in the past passages, I have mentioned that the men of David were not alone. They had not abandoned their families. Their families were with them, with David. David's daily requirement to feed this many folks under his care, who were looking to him, believing in him, was massive. And, as the writer tells us, David has his family with him also, his two wives. We should not forget that Abigail had her five maids with her also. This move from the rock of the wild goats was quite an endeavor. For whatever reason, Achish allowed David and the crowd with him to remain in Gath. And after a while, and it was not long, David proved himself fortified by no doubt of any kind of action of his men and their families. David proved that he would be faithful to Achish. And that the writer tells as of David being given the Philistine town of Ziklag. After a while, and it was not long, David proved himself, fortified no doubt by his kind actions of his men and their families, that the writer tells us of David being given the Philistine town of Ziklag. Verse number 5. Then David said to Achish, "If now I have found favor in your sight, let them give me a place in one of the cities in the country, that I may live there. For why should your servants live in the royal city with you?" So Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Therefore Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. The number of days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months. So our writer has summarized how long David is going to be there with the king of Gath. And now he's going to turn around and tell us what happened during that time of 1 year and 4 months. We are thankful to this writer because he's given us this time marker. However, we must be mindful that this writer who contributed to this book, Samuel, Gad, and Nathan, they always gave a summary in the time markers before they actually told us what happened. What do I mean? It means that the writer of this portion of the passage was writing long after the events recorded in 1 Samuel had come to an end and David was already the king of Judah. Now he's writing it all up. But at this time in the storyline that's being written down long after, David's not the king yet of Judah. He would not become the king for another 1 year and 4 months from this time and that David stood in front of Achish for the second time. During that time, Achish gave David the Philistine town of Ziklag that was right on the border of the Philistine and Jubal tribal land. It moved the border a little bit. But at this point in the story, Ziklag belongs to David, but it's still part of the Philistine property. For now, Ziklag belongs to the Philistine tribal area, although David owns the town. When David becomes the king of Judah, the town and that portion of the Philistine tribal area will become the property of the future king of Judah. With the gift of Ziklag, David and his men, with all their families, moved to Ziklag as their permanent home. After some time settling in Ziklag, a raid occurs. David kills the inhabitants from Sur to Egypt. Verse number 8. Now David and his men went up and raided the Gershites and the Gerzites and the Amalekites, for they were the inhabitants of the land from ancient times, as you come to Sur, even as far as the land of Egypt. David attacked the land and did not leave a man or a woman alive, and he took away the sheep, the cattle, the donkeys, the camels, and the clothing. Then he returned and came to Achish. Why would David do this? We actually do not know, but we can speculate. While living in the walled city of Gath, David and his men and their families had the resources to feed everyone. However, Ziklag was not a walled city. It was just simply a village on the outskirts of Gath. Resources there may have been scarce, and that as the reason for the need of a raid of some communities in order to provide for the families. That scenario is most likely the reason. David raided the communities of three families, the Gershurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites, from Sur to Egypt. Now, in previous passages, we have discussed the coming out of Egypt. There was this main road coming out of Egypt that led east to the village of Sur. And the area around Sur was called the Wilderness of Sur, and the trade route was called the Way of Sur, all the way from Egypt even up into the land of the Promised Land and up through the Philistine land too. All right, sadly, the village of Sur has not survived, and we do not know its location. However, the Way of Sur and the Wilderness of Sur have survived. On that major trade route that may cross across the Philistine land, but may not have either. We're not quite sure, because the roads tend to move a little bit, but we know the road. It traveled by the well-known road that goes through Gath, and they had to go through Gath, and they may have gone around Gath on that way to Sur, but on the way back with the spoils, it may have been better to stay on that well-known traveled road all the way back to Ziklag. So these families, the Gershites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites, were not in just three villages. They were in multiple villages on that trade route from Sur to Egypt. The Wilderness of Sur and the Way of Sur were in the land owned by Egypt, by the way, not owned by the Philistines, not owned by the Israelites. But in that case, we might well assume that the writer is telling us that David raided these families wherever they lived in the Wilderness of Sur, on that Way of Sur, west to the land of Goshen, and near the capital, which was near the capital of Egypt at the time, a place called Tanis. David surely did not go into the capital, but kept his distance. He did not go into Egypt. He kept his distance. Yet he killed these three family groups in these villages as they lived there from Sur to Egypt. The writer tells us about these three families that were inhabitants of the land from ancient times. And all this means to us that these families had lived in this part of the Egyptian wilderness on the way of Sur for hundreds and hundreds of years. And you might notice that only one family was called the Amalekites. Yes, this is the tribe of which Saul was supposed to have destroyed every Amalekite wherever they lived. But Saul had failed to kill every Amalekite, and it was his undoing as king more than 35 years before this time in the passage. It was when the Lord pronounced that Saul's lineage would not hold the throne in the future, and David would later be anointed to be the next king. And at this point in the story, David is 28 years old. Within 2 years, he's going to be king. Well, back in Gath, with all the spoils of the raid, we hear David is questioned by the king of Gath. Verse number 10. Now Achish said, "Where have you made a raid today?" And David said, "Against the Negev of Judah, and against the Negev of the Jerahmeelites, and against the Negev of the Kenites." David did not leave a man or a woman alive to bring to Gath, saying, "Otherwise they will tell about us, saying, so David has done, and so has been his practice all the time he has lived in the country of the Philistines." So Achish believed David, saying, "He has surely made himself odious among his people, Israel. Therefore, he will become my servant forever." David was nowhere near the Negev. Neither was he near the people of Judah, his own tribe, the Jerahmeelites, the descendants of who were descendants of the firstborn of Hezron, the son of Perez, the son of Judah. He wasn't there. It was a tribal family of Judah living on the southern border of Judah. Nor did he attack the Kenites, who were living with and under the protection of Judah, who traced their heritage back to Moses' father-in-law, a Midianite, and a little specific tribe of the Midianites called the Kenites. The writer tells us that David did not leave a soul alive to bring word to Achish to dispute his testimony about where he had come from raiding that day, because it was all a lie. Here we must admit the obvious. David lied to Achish. Folks, this was a dark period in David's life. He was on the run from Saul in fear of his life. David seemed to believe what all of Saul's men were investigating or instigating Saul's hatred on David. That's what he thought. His men were instigating Saul's hatred to David. And therefore, David must have doubted his future as the king of Israel. And according to this passage, David continued to raid and kill people, taking the spoils, no doubt, to feed the men and families with him. And David continued to lie to cover up his actions and save himself from the men and his men from the wrath of Achish, the king of Gath. Finally, the writer reports that Achish believed that David's murderous raids had cast a disparaging opinion on David among all the Israelites. And as such, David could not go back to Israel. And therefore, Achish saw the opportunity to harness David, his ability, and his men to help him as servants of the Philistines for as long as David lived. A most unfortunate chapter break occurs at this point. The thought of Achish is not complete without the first verse of the next chapter, chapter 28.